Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Growing Fangs by Philippa Norcross and Michael Anderley. Narrated by Patricia Santomasso. Chapter 1.
I'm so sorry, Ms. Rohde. The biopsy came back. It's positive.
Cora felt the last tattered scraps of hope float away in the wind, leaving her a hollow shell of a woman sitting in the doctor's office. She was dying. Dead woman walking, really.
Stage 4,
the doctor continued, his tone kind but clinical. She couldn't imagine being in his shoes, having to give this information. How often did he have to do so? He was an oncologist. She couldn't even remember his name. She could barely remember her own at this point.
Can you hear me, Ms. Rohde?
Cora shook herself slightly and forced herself to meet his eyes. Yes. Yes, I can hear you. Sorry. His smile was gentle and warm, the corners of his mouth crinkling his cheeks. He was probably in his late 50s. White hairs were just starting to turn his thick head of hair into salt and pepper. He was ruddy-faced and thin, and looked like the kind of guy who spent his weekends out at the lake, probably building his own cabin. The kind of guy who never had to deal with stuff like this himself. Or had, and had come through it the other side. It was hard to tell.
No apologies necessary. I know this must be hard to take. Your file says you've been to a few doctors. Trying to figure this out, I assume?
She nodded mutely. Migraines ran in her family. It was a pretty common side effect when you had a family of telekinetics. Overuse and mental stress caused headaches no matter what, but telekinetic magic really did seem to put extra pressure on the brain. She hadn't thought much of it for a long time. Her mom had gotten migraines, and her grandma. Nothing new there. When she'd talked to her mom about it, she'd told Cora she wasn't surprised. She'd had an uptick in the headaches when she'd turned 32. These things happen, her mom had said. Ride it out. Don't use your magic. Be gentle with yourself. But the migraines hadn't stopped. They had kept getting worse, even when she wasn't using her magic. When she'd started noticing her vision being affected without an accompanying headache, she'd gone to her doctor. Again. Of course, old Dr. Cawthorn in Joseph's Landing was old. Old school, old-fashioned, prone to declaring things female hysteria. She'd only started going to him out of necessity, and she'd dealt as much as possible with his young intern, Alex. They'd been able to prescribe everything Cora needed on a regular basis, like birth control, the things she didn't want to talk to George Cawthorn about. But this, Alex had said ruefully when Cora had come to them, was beyond their skill level. This, they had to kick up the chain. Cora had submitted to Dr. Cawthorn's antique methods of magical medical diagnosis and had been firmly told that she was suffering from an overuse of magic.
Women your age should be limiting their intense magical use, Cawthorn had informed her primly.
Making sandwiches and having babies, no doubt, Cora had thought grumpily. She'd tried St. Damien's intern program next. She'd gotten a dreamboat on her first visit, an absolute gentleman of a grad student, just starting his doctor of magical medicine. She'd doubted sincerely that what's-his-name had the experience to diagnose something like this, but even just being in the same room as him had been calming. He was the one who'd suggested she talk to an amagical doctor. He wasn't sure what it was, but he highly recommended an MRI.
Enough guesswork, he'd told her kindly. You need the big guns. I can ask my supervisor to refer you to Dr. Moore in Thunder Bay. He's great. Can you get there?
Cora had promised him she could, and that was that. The intern, Cole, that was his name, had said he couldn't guarantee when she would get in, but he'd promised to put the request in as urgent. She'd had to go back to St. Damien's 3 more times before she'd finally gotten the notice that the referral had gone through, and that she had an appointment at the Thunder Bay Health Sciences Center. She hadn't gotten Cole again, which had rather disappointed her, But the interns she had gotten had all been quite competent, and it helped her with the pain, so she couldn't complain.
And now she was here, in Dr. Moore's office, after 3 nights in an Airbnb that she could barely afford. Finding out 6 months after she'd first started to suspect it was more than migraines, that she was dying.
Dr. Moore, she was so glad she'd remembered his name, but why that was the point of joy in her head right now, she couldn't understand, was looking at her, not saying anything, probably expecting her to burst into tears or wail in misery or something. How did terminal cancer patients usually handle this news? She had no idea.
Is there anything you can do? She finally asked, and her voice sounded like it was coming from at least 2 provinces over. His lips twitched downward, and he blinked once, a little slower than a normal blink. Carefully practiced relaxations of the natural human impulse to wince when they had to deliver unfortunate news. That meant, of course, that the answer was going to be no.
I'm sorry, he began. It's not likely. If we'd caught it a little earlier, we might have been able to operate. But the tumor has metastasized beyond what we can remove without causing even more damage to your brain. You might live, but your quality of life would be not great. Based on where the tumor is located, you'd likely lose a lot of mobility, and very possibly your ability to speak.
A lump grew in her throat. Not being able to speak meant not being able to sing. And for some reason, that was what finally kicked her emotions into gear.
I see.
Her voice cracked at the end of the word, and she didn't bother trying to say anything more. What was there to say, anyway?
Mrs. Rohde, is there anyone you can talk to about this?
She was watching the kind, avuncular man through a film of tears. Or was that another migraine coming on? She couldn't tell. She was so disconnected from her body right now, it was anyone's guess.
No.
There was, of course. There was her mother, but Cora didn't want to call her mother.
No friends or family? No partner?
The image of Matt flashed into her mind. Tall and powerfully built, running his hand through his thick, dirty blonde hair before sliding into his wolf form. She shook her head.
No, I didn't tell him about the biopsy. I can't.
Her voice gave out again. She swallowed hard and reached across the desk, plucking the brochures on palliative care from the little stand. May as well. If she was going to die, maybe she should be comfortable. Wasn't that what people did? That, or they went off on one last great adventure, knocking as many things off their bucket lists as they possibly could before kicking said bucket. Of course, if she couldn't see straight, that put a damper on things. Dr. Moore let her take them before saying,
I'd like to schedule a follow-up scan for you in 2 weeks. That should help us make a more exact prognosis, and we can discuss care options.
No, thank you. She interrupted him. No, thank you. I'll call whoever I need to call.
Are you sure?
He leaned forward, frowning slightly.
It can be difficult to get into these things if you don't have the right connections. It's a sad but true fact about the Canadian healthcare system. You're in now, Miss Rohde. You can take advantage of that.
Cora stared at him blankly for a long moment, before finally asking, How long do I have? The doctor gazed back at her for an equally long moment before replying,
I don't want to sound like I'm harping on the follow-up scan, but without it, it's hard for me to say for sure.
Cora waved her hand dismissively.
Give me a ballpark.
He pursed his lips briefly.
A conservative estimate would be 3 to 6 months.
She closed her eyes, the words hitting her like punches to the gut.
And a less conservative estimate?
I might say as long as a year, but I'd only see that happening if you were in inpatient care for most of that time. And again, quality of life,
That's chemo, radiation, and all that, right? She opened her eyes again. She had no doubt there was absolutely no emotion showing in them right now, because she was back to feeling nothing at all.
Yes,
he confirmed simply, nodding.
But if you needed that extra time to get everything in order...
He reached across and tapped the brochures in her hand.
Those include plenty of information and numbers, lots of good resources. People who can help you get everything in order without costing you a fortune and without making everything worse.
He then pulled a business card from a smaller stand next to the one with the brochures and slid it across the desktop to her.
This is my card. Take the night, take a couple nights, and leave me a message if you change your mind about the follow-up scan. I know this is a shock, and I know how awful it is to try to get what you need after the fact. I try to keep the door open for my patients as long as possible. I'll do whatever I can to help you, okay? I'm here for you, Miss Rhodey.
She nodded, her voice once again deserting her, and she added the business card to her little pile of paper. She got up from the chair and numbly took her jacket from the hook on the wall. It felt like she'd hung it up hours ago. Days ago. But she knew her appointment had been for 10:30, and the clock on the wall only said 10:47. Time had stopped making sense a long time ago, granted. Another symptom that she'd suspected meant, this isn't just a magical migraine. She put her coat on and, with a silent nod to Dr. Moore, walked out of the office. She went through the sterile hallways of the health center without a word, her environment blurring in her peripheral vision. She kept her gaze straight ahead, neatly avoiding orderlies and techs and nurses as they hurried along to do their work. She managed well enough until she almost ran into a fellow in a wheelchair turning down the hallway to the elevators.
I'm so sorry, sir,
she stammered, catching herself just shy of falling on top of him. The older gentleman grinned up at her.
No problem, miss.
His grin showed a few missing teeth.
You look like you're on a mission.
She laughed through the blur, which she knew was tears because she felt them on her face.
I guess so.
Both the laugh and her voice sounded false. He looked past her and his grin fell.
Oncology. Ah.
He reached over and took her hand. His skin was papery, but his hand was warm. And when he ran his thumb over the back of her hand, she couldn't help but remember her grandfather, who'd passed away almost 10 years ago, also from cancer.
I'm so sorry, miss.
That was all anyone was going to say to her now, wasn't it? Chapter 2. She extracted herself from the kindly old man with a minimum of extra tears, much to her silent surprise. The ice was growing over her now, the ice that would keep her from driving her car into a tree on the way home. Home. Joseph's Landing. The place she'd lived almost her whole life after her mom had left her dad when Cora and her sister were just kids. From the Kootenays to the Great Lakes was a huge change, but when you were 4, everything was a huge change. Life since then had been calm, quiet. Her mom settled into her new job at the school, working as the administrative assistant, a job she'd held since they moved. Cora and Julie went through elementary, then high school. Julie went off to England to study. Cora went to upstate New York. Mom kept working. Cora met Matt. Cora started getting migraines. She paid for her parking at the pay station in the lobby, hardly cognizant of the ridiculous number that popped up on the screen. She'd been there half an hour, and it was still charging her in the double digits. Oh well, she'd be dead soon anyway, so what did it matter? Out in the parking lot, it was already getting cold. It was only October, but the weather was turning chilly. The almanac said it was going to be a nasty winter. Get your snow tires on early. Be ready for black ice any time. The kind of winter Cora hated. Not that she liked winter much anyway. It was her least favorite season and always had been. It was part of the reason she'd entertained the notion of going south to study opera, at least until she'd gotten the partial scholarship to New York State. And of course, it hadn't hurt that she'd ended up close enough to Matt that they'd been able to keep up the relationship they'd started either. That being said, upstate New York winters really hadn't given her any more reason to like winter. She'd been thinking about going to New Mexico again, maybe trying for the Santa Fe Opera Apprentice Program again. Then the migraines had gotten worse. She fumbled with her keys, trying to find the unlock button with her chilled thumb until she dropped them in the gutter. She crouched, going after them, and the wet leaves just made her hand colder. When she finally found her keys and managed to press the button, she realized the car she was standing in front of wasn't even her own, and she burst into angry, helpless tears as she walked the two cars over to her little Chevy Aveo. Dark blue, her favorite color. Would the tumor mess with her ability to see color soon? Would she start losing her sight? No, Dr. Moore hadn't said anything about losing her sight, her mobility and her speech, but not her sight. As if that were any better. She slumped into the driver's seat and let herself cry for a moment because she couldn't do anything else. Her arms and legs suddenly felt like they were lead weights, and she couldn't tell if she couldn't see because she was crying or because she had a stage 4 brain tumor that was going to kill her. Either or, really. She reached over and grabbed a pack of Kleenex from her glove compartment, blowing her nose into one and wiping her eyes furiously with another. Slowly, her tears cleared enough that she could see. The pounding headache was nothing new anymore. She'd checked out of her Airbnb that morning, so she had to go home. Why she hadn't given herself a day or two of margin on the other side of the appointment, she didn't know. Misplaced hope, maybe? She turned the key in the ignition and listened as the engine sputtered to life, then put it in gear and slowly pulled away from the curb. As the car finished starting up, the Bluetooth transceiver automatically connected to her phone in her purse and started playing what she'd been listening to when she arrived that morning, the original London cast recording of Phantom of the Opera. Old, comforting listening. The album she turned to whenever she needed to really lose herself in the music. 2 decades on from the first time she'd heard it, she knew every word and could sing every part. She didn't feel like singing just yet. When she tried, nothing came out. She just turned it back to the beginning and let the talk of the auctioneer's gavel resound through her skull. She counted turns as she headed for the highway. It was a habit she'd picked up from her mother, who'd used it to learn routes in new cities. Cora's mom had always had trouble following maps. Cardinal directions were not her strong point, but she could remember the number of lefts and rights. Cora had no such trouble herself, but it reminded her of her mom, and she needed a little bit of that right now to distract her from the renewed waves of tears that were threatening to overflow and to distract her from the fact that she was dying. God, she was getting tired of thinking that already. She was barely 30 years old. Her life shouldn't be defined by a broken record of, "You're going to die." How stupid was that? How tiresome? How many times had she read books or watched movies and TV shows where the main character was so focused on one thought that it blocked everything else out? Tiresome really was the word. There was more to life than that, even now. Even after this, there was more. Wasn't there? The tears could no longer be contained, and they flowed down her cheeks. There probably was more, but she couldn't find it anymore. She turned the volume up just as the auctioneer finished his spiel about the chandelier, right in time for the opening chords of the overture to blast through the speakers. She was briefly tempted to close her eyes and let the music pound through her head and her soul. She didn't care how much it hurt. The headache was killing her anyway, and she didn't know when those jokes would start being old, but it hadn't happened yet. But the little voice of survival instinct managed to keep her eyes open. For now. She had no doubt L'Appel du Vide would be strong as hell for the next 8 hours of driving.
8 hours. She'd make it through the album 4-ish times, depending on how many times she repeated her favorite songs. She'd be well and truly out of voice by the time she got home. That was if her voice ever started working again. The pipe organ of the overture drowned out her thoughts, however briefly, as the familiar melodies and harmonies ran through well-paved synapses, and the even more familiar surges of emotion swelling in her chest made her cry more. She pulled over. She couldn't drive like this, no matter how hard she tried. She had to let some of this out, or she'd end up driving into a ditch. She put the car in park, just sitting on the side of the road, and leaned forward to rest her head on the steering wheel. She reached over blindly and felt her way across the dashboard until she found the button for her four-ways, which she pressed. The tick-tock was at odds with the time signature of the music, so she then drifted her hand down and turned the music up to drown it out. For a few minutes, she let the orchestra and the voices drown everything out. Then she got to think of me, and her mouth opened of its own accord, and she began to sing along. She'd been doing this for years upon years at this point. She barely even realized she was doing it. She sang into her steering wheel, feeling the sympathetic vibrations coming back through the rubber into her skull. For a few moments, her headache even lessened. She must have found a good frequency by sheer luck. And then she hit the middle of the song, where Raoul came in, and the tears washed over her face again. Matt could only carry a tune in a bucket if it had fewer than 5 pitches and was in a very specific range, but that didn't matter. He came to mind anyway, cued by the Vicomte de Chagny's astonishment at finding his childhood sweetheart once again, and Cora broke down in tears. She wouldn't be able to sit here forever. Her gas would run out, she'd get hungry, she'd need to sleep, she'd get a parking ticket. She had to go home. She had to go tell Matt. She had to tell Matt and her mother and her sister that she was going to die. And that before she died, she might well lose her mobility and her ability to speak, and therefore her ability to sing. What else would she lose? How much would the cancer take from her before it took her life? Would she lose her hearing entirely? If not, what about her ability to appreciate music, to understand it? Would it all become cacophony? She knew a little bit about brains, mostly what she'd learned in the last few months, as she'd frantically researched what might be happening to her. All of it had terrified her. Eventually, she would lose it all. And on the way there, she'd turn into even more of a shell of herself. Especially if she opted for treatment. If she tried to kill it. If she tried to prolong her life. She'd seen cancer patients before. Who hadn't? How dead they looked, well before they actually died. Matt would see that. It was one thing for her mother to see her like that. It was her mother. And her sister, Julie, would probably catch the first flight back from England she could. Cora found she didn't mind that so much. Family was supposed to be there for the harsh stuff like this. The idea of Matt seeing her like that bothered her deeply, though. It wasn't that she thought he couldn't handle it, or that he wouldn't want to. Quite the opposite. Matt St. Clair was the kind of guy you found once in a blue moon. Kind, sweet, utterly devoted, hilarious, caring. Cora had always thought she would never want to get married, but she had actually entertained the idea of marrying Matt. Matt, upon hearing that Cora was dying, would insist on being with her right until the end. He would insist on doing everything he could for her, no matter what, and he wouldn't flinch away from any of it. He would grieve deeply and darkly, because shifters never did anything by halves. Knowing him, he'd beg his sister to do whatever she could to help Cora. Maggie St. Clair was a time witch, and maybe she could do something. Cora didn't know. More likely, Maggie would look at her sadly and shake her head. Cora would be no better off than before, and Matt would be even sadder. She felt trapped. She just wanted out.
The thrumming beat of the musical's title song began, and with it came a wave of determination and courage. Cora swiped her sleeve over her streaming eyes, sniffed harshly, put the car back into drive, and then turned away from the highway.
Chapter 3.
Cora paced the square hotel room. One wall, bed, second wall, desk, third wall, door, fourth wall, mini fridge. One wall, two, three, four. One, two, three, four.
What was she doing? What the hell was she thinking?
Only that she couldn't go home. Not yet. Not without a plan. Not without something. What could one woman do against stage 4 brain cancer? She hadn't looked up the actual statistics on people who'd gotten the same diagnosis as she had. She hadn't even opened the damn folder. She had no doubt that hundreds of thousands of people had tried and failed. So what the hell made her think she could do it? Hubris? Insanity? Probably. That didn't mean she wasn't going to try. She threw herself onto the bed and almost bounced back off it. She hadn't exactly sprung for the Ritz. This was barely a step up from a sketchy roadside motel. She didn't even remember the name of the chain. She hadn't been paying attention. She'd seen the signs for free Wi-Fi and continental breakfast and a room rate under $100, and she'd turned in. What did she care if there were bedbugs? She was gonna die anyway. Your impending demise really did have a way of sticking with you. Once she righted herself on the bed, she sat cross-legged and grabbed her backpack from the head of the bed. She pulled her laptop out and set it on her lap, then fired up her music player and scrolled until an album caught her eye. Götterdämmerung. Well, it wasn't her favorite opera, but it sure was emotionally appropriate. Wagner it was. She logged into the hotel's Wi-Fi and opened her browser. Let the Googling begin. She didn't bother filtering anything. She pulled it all up. From the mainstream to the most esoteric, she found and read everything she could about methods of healing the human body. She even logged into her university library account and started hunting through their magical medical journals. Magical medicine was all over finding a cure for cancer, just like everyone else. First, she made herself read through the tedium and the heart-wrenching fear of mainstream medicine. Chemotherapy, radiation, radiosurgery, all of it. She read study after study about the operability of brain tumors, how they responded to different types of radiation, how chemotherapy drugs affected not only cancer cells, but also the human body, and the extra risks inherent in treating a tumor so deeply embedded within her brain. It would have been one thing if the thing were growing off her liver, for instance, but nestled into her brain? Well, she could understand why Dr. Moore had told her surgery was no longer an option. Once she'd exhausted modern medicine and two cups of horrid instant coffee from the tiny coffee maker on top of her mini fridge, she moved on to traditional medicine. She'd always been wary of naturopaths and herbal medicine, but she didn't have anything else to lose at this point. She read about enough herbs and tinctures that she started thinking the people who practiced these sorts of medicine either fancied themselves witches or really were witches, and either didn't know or didn't think they could tell anyone. There were a lot of references to plants that Cora, despite not being a plant witch, knew to be legit potion-making and alchemy ingredients. That said, she didn't find anything that struck her as feasible for curing cancer. Cleansing your bloodstream of toxins produced by a stray hex? Sure. Turning your skin green? Gotcha covered. But killing a massive tumor in the middle of your brain? Not so much. Herbs finished, she poked into traditional Chinese medicine. She was even more wary here. Not because of the provenance, but because of her provenance. She'd always suspected that traditional Chinese medicine had roots in the magic of the area, though, of course, China was a very large place, encompassing many diverse cultures. It seemed that people without
sample complete. Ready to continue?